Welcome to Mysterious Japan, created by Heath Havey and dedicated to the dark histories, ghost stories, and frightful folklore of Japan. These are the stories that give nightmares to the Japanese. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to episode 17 of Mysterious Japan, The Ashes of Error. This is the second episode of season 3. Our focus in this season is the cursed location and later inferno at the Hotel New Japan. In episode 16, we explored the many historical legends and curses on the property from times past. These created in the Japanese a charged sense that the place is cursed and abandoned by the gods. A place of Tatari. A place where evil is left to roam and where tragedy will escalate unaided by the divine. But what changed the location of this hotel from a mere historical and paranormal oddity to a place cursed with Tatari? Most point to the tragic and deadly blaze that swept through the hotel in 1982. This episode, while incredible and tragic, is entirely factual. It is pieced together from court testimony, investigation results, eyewitness accounts, and media reports. Sometimes, it seems, real people can be worse than the demons they let in, and real tragedy can be more horrifying than the fiction they dream up. Part 1. The Young Brit and the Cigarette. On February 7, 1982, a 23-year-old toy salesman named Steve Dicker flew from Great Britain to Japan on business. After a long day of flying, he checked into his room on the 9th floor of Hotel New Japan. With jet lag hitting him hard that night, he went to the hotel bar for a drink, which ended up being many drinks. Although he spoke no Japanese, he struck up a conversation with the bartender. In halting English, the bartender told him that many Taiwanese and Korean guests were at the hotel for the Sapporo Snow Festival tour, and they also did not speak Japanese. Hotel New Japan was known for hosting foreigners in Japan for events, once expected to house foreigners for the 1964 Tokyo Olympics to show off the recovery of Japan after the war. Its strange design was meant to give windows and great views to all clientele, but its interior was a confusing floor plan of intersecting hallways. On this fateful night, about 60 guests on the 9th and 10th floors were from South Korea and Taiwan, and 103 guests, almost a fourth of all guests, were on the 9th and 10th floors. At about 1 a.m., Steve Dicker took the elevator back up to the 9th floor and stumbled into room 938. In his hand, he held a carton of cigarettes and a bottle of whiskey. Steve had fewer than 3 hours to live. Steve turned on the television and began smoking. An ashtray full of cigarette butts would be found by his bed. Steve followed each cigarette with swigs of whiskey in an attempt to force himself to sleep despite the jet lag. Although the Japan time was 1 a.m., it was barely 4 p.m. in London. After a while, his eyes start to close. He suddenly jerks awake. Experts testified this would have been about 3 a.m. His cigarette had fallen to the floor, and the carpet was on fire. He jumped to his feet. Grabbing the bedspread, he threw it over the tiny fire and stomped out the embers. To his drunken mind, tragedy was averted. He left the blanket to cover the scorched area and fell back on the bed to let the Japanese television show lull him back to sleep, but only after taking a few more swigs from the whiskey bottle. This time, in his drunken stupor, sleep came almost immediately. While Steve slept, the tiny embers spread from the carpet to the bedspread laid over them. The fire started at 3:24 a.m. By the time the smoke woke up Steve at 3:30 a.m., the flames were too big to smother and the room was full of smoke. Half drunk and half asleep, he stumbled out of the bed, coughing and reeling. But he was not able to open the hotel door. The pressure from the heat and smoke prevented it. Part 2. The Bumbling Staff. Only 4 staff employees were on duty at this time of night. A front man, a front desk manager, a room service employee, and a page. To maintain anonymity during trial, court records refer to them as employees A through D. 5 security guards were also on duty and were referred to as guards A through E. When the fire started, 4 of the guards were asleep. At 3:17 a.m., the front desk manager relieved the front man. 13 minutes later, at 3:30 a.m., the frontman took the elevator up to the 9th floor. He planned to catch some sleep in room 968, an empty room used by employees for naps. Upon reaching the 9th floor, he noted a smoky odor. He checked the ashtray in the hall by the elevator. The ashtray was not the source of the smell. As he followed his nose, he happened upon room 938. Tendrils of smoke flowed into the hall from the cracks around the door. Above, the smoke billowed gently on the ceiling and rolled down the hall. The frontman stood paralyzed momentarily, unsure of proper protocol. Under the dictatorial direction of hotel owner Yokoi, the hotel never provided any fire training to its employees. In his misguided efforts to save money, Yokoi skipped safety requirements. Among these, he never trained staff on emergency procedures. The frontman knocked on the door. He is asking the person within, "Are you okay? Is there an emergency? It looks like an emergency." He repeated these statements in a loud voice, but there was no response. He yells at the door, "It looks like an emergency." Steve does not understand Japanese, and it is unclear if he heard anything. Within the room, Steve still stumbled around in a drunken stupor, so he may not have even heard the knocking at the door. The frontman did not have the key. He pulled no alarms. He did not call the front desk on the house phone. Instead, he took the elevator back down to the first floor to find the master key. Downstairs, he told the front desk manager and the room service maid about the possible fire. Together, the three of them took the elevator to the 9th floor. It was now 3:35 a.m. Seeing the smoke pour much more fiercely from the door now, the front desk manager banged his fist hard on the door and asked after the guest. Smoke wafted steadily through the crack under the door. From inside, they heard a man's voice say in English,
"Help me, please, help me."
The maid fumbled with the master key, her hand shaking as she turned it to open the door. She pushed, but the door did not move. The heat from inside pushed back. She could not get it to budge. The manager picked up the house phone down the hall to call security. Downstairs, the guard who received the call, Guard A, started waking up the other four who were asleep. He ordered Guard B to ring the emergency bell as he headed up to the 9th floor. Guard A was unsure about the proper response. He did not know how bad the fire was, and he hesitated to call emergency services unless it became absolutely necessary. Yokoi would surely fire them if they created a panic. He also delayed calling for an evacuation of guests. When asked why they delayed, staff testified that they were afraid of losing their jobs if they acted hastily or angered Yokoi. Back upstairs, the frontman and maid heaved together, finally managing to push the door open. They both leaped back in surprise. A naked white man pushed past them, stumbling and coughing. The maid screamed at seeing a naked Englishman spring at them from inside. Smoke and steam rose from his bare skin like a white-fleshed monster escaping hell. Steve staggered down the hall to the right, drunk and incoherent, and then turned right. Unfortunately for him, the elevators had been to the left. Naked and covered in soot, he collapsed in a drunken stupor at a dead end. The staff stood dumbstruck in the doorway. The maid testified that she saw a bedstand table with an ashtray full of cigarette butts and a half-empty bottle of whiskey. The fire had burnt through most of the bed, sending smoke everywhere. Flames crawled up the wall and ceiling. The manager grabbed the fire extinguisher from the central hallway wall. Even after the extinguisher gasped and emptied the last of its chemicals, the fire still raged. Downstairs, Guard B stood gawking at the alarm system. No one had trained him how to operate the manual alarms. It was not as easy as pulling a switch or pushing a button. Unable to figure it out, he never started the alarm. Back on the 9th floor, the manager looked around for another fire extinguisher, but there was only the one. He took the stairs down to the central hall on the 8th floor and grabbed the fire extinguisher there before returning to room 938. While the manager was gone, the frontman ran to the fire hydrant hose on the 9th floor. But like the security guard, he never received training and could not figure out how to open or close the valve to operate it. Behind him, the fire grew and expanded. Smoke poured out the open doorway, backlit by the raging fire. The maid, manager, and frontman returned to the burning room. The bed and entire room had become too hot to enter, and poisonous smoke and gas poured out. During their attempt to find extinguishers and the fire hose, they had left the door open. This fed the fire with additional oxygen flowing through the door. Before they could react, a flashover event blew flames violently into the hallway, immediately spreading to the guest room next door. The three of them realized extinguishers would now be futile. The fire was out of control. Without delay, and without notifying any of the guests on the floor, they jumped into the employee elevator and took it down to the fourth floor before the smoke and fire could reach them. They left 368 people sleeping in the floors above them, and they had no idea what to do when a fire raged out of control in their hotel. It was 3:39 a.m. No longer contained, the fire had grown into a full-scale inferno. Still, no fire alarms had gone off, and none of the sprinklers in the ceiling turned on. The criminal investigation uncovered that they were dummy sprinkler heads Yokoi had installed to fool the fire department, and they were not connected to any water pipes. And downstairs, the emergency broadcast, emergency bell, and smoke detector in the hotel did not work. The untrained staff failed to call emergency services. Due to cost-cutting measures eliminating staff phones, they had to use the guest rooms and had no direct outside line. They could not make an immediate emergency call without receiving an extension from the front desk, and so they waited for that extension so they could make a phone call. With every second counting, they were just waiting for an available line. During this time, they still did not wake up or evacuate any guests. In fact, no other guests were aware of the fire until a female guest in the room adjacent to Steve Dicker's room started screaming. Part 3. Panic and Desperation. After being abandoned by hotel staff without any notice of a raging fire, guests were left alone to wake up, realize the hotel was on fire, and evacuate themselves in the middle of the night while surrounded by smoke. Without hotel staff or firefighters present, Kim Tae-dong, a 63-year-old former South Korean communications minister, began guiding guests to evacuate. He was leading a 17-member delegation to a management conference. He focused on ensuring all of his subordinates made it off the floor alive, but he himself collapsed during this heroic effort, dying of smoke inhalation. His body was found among the casualties. One third of them would not survive the night. Amidst a fire that jumped from room to room, guests on the 9th and 10th floors had few options. Their stories reverberate as both awful and awe-inspiring. On the 6th floor, 45-year-old Kuroku Nishikawa woke from a deep slumber, coughing and rubbing his red and swollen eyes. Smoke filled the room, and panic rushed over him. It took him a moment to realize where he was and why. He was here for a relative's wedding. This was supposed to be a short trip of celebration, a vacation from running his busy clothing store in Hokkaido. As he came fully awake and realized a fire blazed somewhere in the hotel, he began to panic, not so much because there was a fire as because he remembered that the hallways were like a maze. He couldn't remember where the stairs were, and people always told him that elevators were too dangerous in a fire. Besides, the power was out. Ducking low, he followed others down the hall to the emergency stairs and made his way down to the lobby and out the door. He turned back to the fleeing guests and left the hotel behind. Later, he told reporters,
"When I managed to get out of the building, I looked up. That's when I saw someone jumping from one of the windows. I heard a dull thumping sound about three times. Three people or one with several levels, I don't know. It's horrible to even think about it now."
Western media identified three Americans affected by the fire. Mal Kravitz was a 33-year-old from California. Since he was on a lower floor, he made it to safety in the evacuation, suffering only mild smoke inhalation. Sharon Poff was not so lucky. The 37-year-old wife of a USAF officer based in Okinawa, her room was on the 9th floor. Eventually, the smoke and flames crowded her, pushing her up to the window with no escape. She had no choice but to jump. Her room faced the street and was over the 4th floor roof. With flames licking at her back, she braced herself at the window, strategically aiming the jump but knowing it might be the last decision she ever made. With a prayer and a push, she launched out and down. Her body impacted the fourth floor terrace 5 floors below, slamming with incredible force. The fall broke both legs, both arms and her pelvis. Remarkably, unlike many others that night, she somehow managed to survive the terrifying drop. The 3-month hospitalization to put her on the road to recovery seemed a small price to pay for surviving that night. The last American was burned beyond recognition. Investigators could only identify her by the partially burnt and melted driver's license, listing her as 56-year-old Mutsudo Furia, also from California. She was the only American casualty. Of course, the Brit, Steve Dickers, who started the fire, never made it past that dead end where he collapsed. Kawamoto, whose first name was not disclosed, slept on the fourth floor when a terrible sound outside his door woke him. He looked out into the hall. Guests crowded around the elevator area panicking and yelling. No one knew where to go. They wandered around looking for the stairs in the dark without a single light to guide their way. Kawamoto turned to the window and parted the curtains. The fourth floor led directly onto the rooftop. He heard sirens, but he could not see the street below because of the dome-like roof rising up in front of him that blocked his view. He decided to avoid the commotion in the corridor. After all, he thought to himself, if this was a true emergency, he would certainly hear alarms and hotel employees would help evacuate. Just a few moments later, something made him realize how wrong he was in this assumption, and that something was horrific. Even as he peered out the window, a body from above crashed into the domed rooftop right in front of him. The shock of seeing this sent Kawamoto flying back in surprise and shock. The body lay there motionless just a few arms' length from his window. Kawamoto tried opening the window, pushing against the locks to help the guest. Finally, he managed to push the window. Immediately, he could tell it was a lost cause. The body was twisted, and the eyes stared lifelessly upward. Kawamoto did not let this stop him. He still stepped out onto the rooftop by the dome. There might still be a chance, and in any case, he would prefer to escape from the domed roof than from inside a hotel on fire full of panicked guests who might trample each other. He stooped down to check for signs of life, aware that moving the body might cause more harm than good. At that moment, a firefighter climbed up over the far rim of the dome roof, running over to assist, having also seen the man jump. He checked the body and shook his head sadly. Even though they confirmed the jumper was dead, they decided to remove it from the site. Kawamoto helped the firefighter lift the body and carry it over to the ladder to lower it to the ground 4 floors below. Before descending himself, Kawamoto looked back at the hotel. At the highest levels, Kawamoto could see the flames engulfing the top 2 floors. Smoke poured out of nearly every window. Then he saw the man on the 9th floor. A man in imminent danger. The guest wore white nightclothes, leaning out the window to escape the smoke. But Kawamoto then saw flames light up behind the man, glowing ominously behind him. Out of options, the man climbed onto the windowsill and then started shuffling to the side of the window, clinging to the bricks as his only support. He grabbed onto a corner piece jutting from the wall and held on while flames shot out of windows on both sides of him. From below, it looked like the waves of flame were tracking him down, following him. Flames that were 20 or 30 feet high. Eventually, he huddled in the corner, holding on desperately and knowing he did not have much time. His feet had little purchase against the smooth white bricks. He relied mostly on his upper body strength to cling to the jutting brick wall. But he would not be able to hold out for long. By then, the media was on site. The television station was just down the street. Reporters caught the struggle of this desperate man on camera. He shifted from one corner to the other, constantly looking down, looking for some way to escape the flames erupting all around him. A picture of this man clinging to the corner would become an iconic image of the fire. Finally, when he felt his grip slipping and his muscles numbing, he knew he could not hold out any longer. As he looked around in desperation, he saw a ladder rescue team. The first responder reached him and grabbed on. The firefighter pulled him to the ladder. His weakened and numbed arms regained some strength as he let hope become exuberance. He grabbed the ladder and held tight. He considered the ladder a godsend. Although he did not identify himself, he told reporters that he was all too aware of the result for failure. His quote would splash the newspapers.
I knew that if I made just one false move, hell was waiting for me.
Part 4. A daring escape attempt. On February 7th, 1982, Norio Yamabashi and his new bride exchanged vows, followed by a reception at Hotel New Japan. Their first night as husband and wife would be spent at the hotel, and the front desk assigned them to room 921. This was a lavish and oversized honeymoon suite. Little did they know that the first night of their marriage would become a nightmare. After his wife fell asleep, Norio tossed and turned listlessly. Following the reception, he complained about the dry air. To him, it felt as dry as a desert. He drank some water and set a wet towel over his face. When that failed, he laid down in the bed, finally succumbing to sleep at about 2:30 a.m. About an hour later, a burning and smoky odor brought him out of his slumber. He breathed in deeply, definitely a smoke smell. He shook and woke his new wife, telling her, "Wake up. Something's not right." It was so early. He checked his watch. The time was 3:42 a.m. He lifted the receiver to dial the operator downstairs, but the line was dead. A few moments later, the light by the bed went out. No power. Norio drew back the curtains. Only a dim glow drifted into the room from outside. Their room, which was on the opposite side of the hotel from Dicker and in a back corner, allowed them no view of the fire, but he could hear sirens approaching down below. He saw the flashing glow from the sirens of fire trucks heading down the street, but from this angle, nothing was visible. He didn't know that, right then, 21 fire engines and an ambulance were pulling up alongside the hotel, soon to be followed by the rescue teams. They quickly dressed. This felt all wrong to Norio. If there was a fire, there should be alarms. There should be an evacuation. He grabbed the doorknob to the hall. It was hot, so he withdrew right away. As he looked down at his hand, he saw smoke snaking in under the door. He wet a towel from the bathroom and set it down to cover the crack. He wondered again to himself, where are the alarms? For 15 minutes, Norio and his new bride waited, alone and afraid, in a near complete darkness with no power. The smell of smoke built up with each passing minute. The wet towel would not hold out smoke and fire for long. Outside, they heard more fire engines and a roar that sounded like a train running on tracks. He couldn't tell what this roaring train sound could be, but later he learned that it was the sound of the lapping fire as it grew and jumped from room to room, combined with the hoses spraying water in a desperate attempt to extinguish the flames. It was one thing to hear the sounds outside the window. It was quite another when they started to hear the sound of roaring flames in the hall outside their door. The fire was about to reach the south wing where they huddled in a corner. It was 4:02 a.m. Another sound suddenly startled them. The water cannons were spraying high-intensity water outside their room. The windows shattered, sending in cold water and chill February air from outside. Smoke escaped out their window. It rushed as if drawn on air currents, but the room was still filling up with smoke. Both husband and wife ran to the opening, leaning out, trying to get fresh air. The heat was building behind them, and the fire was at their door. They stayed like that, breathing in the outside air while hoping for rescue, for several minutes. It was 4:10 a.m. when they saw the unfurling of a rope made of sheets. Above them and one room to the left, they saw a man in his nightclothes drop a rope made out of sheets tied together. This was like something they had seen in the movies. Surely it couldn't work in real life. This man descending the sheets was Yoon, a Korean businessman, staying in room 1014 on the 10th floor. He hated the hotel from the beginning. Ever since checking in, he kept feeling static electricity. The hotel felt off a bad omen, to be sure. Once his room filled with smoke, he could hardly breathe. The water cannons blew out his window. No flames entered his room, but the smoke pouring in from the 9th floor concerned him. He went to the window and leaned out. After a couple of breaths, he started inhaling the smoke pouring out of the window. He knew he would die of smoke inhalation if he didn't do something. There was no way the firefighters would put out this fire and rescue him in time. That was obvious by the walls of flame he saw flickering out almost every window on the top two floors. He looked down at the ladder crews below and knew there was no way they could reach his room, not at its odd angle and height. He had an idea, but he would have to act before it was too late. He took four sheets and tied them together. This was harder to do than he thought. He had to work in the smoke-filled haze, coughing as the smoke entered his lungs, but at last it was done. He tied one end of the sheet rope to the bed and hung the other out the window like he had seen in prison escape movies. The fact that it worked amazed him. His nerves left him. The ground was 150 feet below him, and the sheets only hung down to the eighth floor. If the fire burnt the sheets, or if he lost his grip, or if the knots didn't hold, or if the sheets ripped, or if any of 100 things went wrong, it would be a horrific fall. But he could stay no longer. He had no choice. The smoke would kill him if he stalled. He grabbed one end and hefted himself over the edge as the newlyweds watched him from below. Donald McGee, a tourist from Australia, was on the eighth floor. His wife and son were in the room with him. McGee opened the window for fresh air and to determine how to escape the smoke-infested floor. It was then that he saw a man dangling from sheets tied together on the ninth floor across the way. But the flames reached the man and his makeshift rope, and McGee watched the poor man scream pitifully and fall to his death. McGee reported to the press.
Finally, the flames just got to him and he dropped.
McGee was luckily able to safely escape with his wife and son, but he too wondered where the alarms were at. He found it difficult to find the exits through the smoke. From across the way, another man saw the guest fall to his death from the dangling sheet. The observer was Yun. Both men had the same idea: climb out on a homemade rope made of sheets. But when he saw that man fall and heard his screaming, and then heard the awful thud followed by no further screams, Yun locked up in terror. All confidence left him. I could be next, he thought. But he was committed now. It was too late. He was halfway between floors. Below him, the Yamabayashi newlyweds could stand it no longer. The heat and smoke would kill them. Even sticking their heads out the window, they couldn't breathe, and the heat on their backs was so intense they could not even turn around. They were about to give up, to shrink in a corner and die together on their first night of marriage, or maybe jump together a last lover's leap. Hope abandoned them. Then Noroi heard something. Someone was calling him from above. It was Yun, still dangling on his sheet rope, lowering himself hand over hand. Noroi turned to face the heat and smoke. He grabbed the sheets from the bed and closet, coughing and wheezing, wiping the tears from red and swollen eyes. He made his own rope from the sheets as quickly as he could. He tied the makeshift rope to the curtain rod and threw it out the window. He helped his bride start down, holding it steady for her. Yun pushed himself horizontally over to the window of the Yamabayashi's. He felt like he was rappelling without any safety gear or belay devices. Noroi's wife made it down to a shattered window on the seventh floor and climbed into the room. Noroi followed while Yun adjusted himself on the windowsill and held the rope steady while Noroi descended. Once in the seventh floor room, Noroi held the rope steady for Yun's descent. Black with soot and coughing non-stop, they ran to the exit and down the stairs, managing somehow to survive the honeymoon nightmare. Yun reports that he thought to himself at the time, "Now I have a business trip that I will never forget." The survivors all had a memory they would never forget, though many would like to. The family of the deceased had Yokoi and his employees to blame. The entire tragedy could have been avoided. The first responders told their own stories of that night, and some of these stories would go on to inspire television specials on Japanese TV and would elevate one crew to the status of national heroes. Those harrowing tales next time on Mysterious Japan.
This has been Mysterious Japan, created, written, and translated by Heath Havey. Thank you for listening and making this podcast possible. Please visit our website at www.themysteriousjapan.com for more information. Please join us next time as we continue to explore the dark histories and strange mysteries of Japan.